Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers who are shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later on the podcast, stay ahead with stories that really matter. And coming up on the program today, global tensions mount as China cautions nations on U.S. trade ties. Recycled wastewater may already be in South Africa's drinking supply. What digital drama is doing to our children and why the new schoolyard is online. And we'll look at a concept called Now, Next and Never Money. It's Wednesday, the 23rd of April. Now, as the world's two largest economies square off in yet another round of trade saber-rattling, China now issuing a direct warning to countries, think twice before signing any trade deals with Washington that could harm Chinese interests. So obviously, the stakes are rising, not just for Washington and Beijing, but for every country caught in between. So here's the obvious question. Where does it leave South Africa and the rest of the global South? Someone in an excellent position to answer that question is Donald McKay from XA Global Trade Advisors. So Donald, welcome to you. What exactly then is China warning against? And I guess what's behind the timeline?
Yeah, so the trade war with China and the US has heated up fairly dramatically over the last few days. And the US is pushing countries that want to do some sort of deal with the US to pick a side. And China, of course, is quite concerned about that. So they don't want this to spiral out much beyond the US. And so China are threatening retaliation if any actions are taken to directly harm China. I mean, you could think of this, you know, these are our two biggest trading partners. The parents are fighting and the kids are being asked to pick a side. And we really are not in a position to be able to do that. We, you know, both of these are very important partners of ours, but that is the position.
In your opinion, how much of this is brinkmanship, or how serious is China about actual retaliation against countries that pursue U.S.-aligned deals?
I think extremely serious. There are extremely severe consequences on China if that were to happen. China is an export-driven economy. It requires a big global market to be as successful as it is. So I think anything which threatens that to an even greater degree than the U.S. has already done is extremely serious. And of course, this is not just about trade. It goes all the way down to spheres of influence. I think China is very concerned that the US is attempting to isolate it completely. And that would certainly have very negative consequences on the Chinese economy. So I think they're deadly serious when they threaten retaliation.
Which means that we're into a new era of transactional relationships, and it signals surely a new phase of economic coercion in global trade if this is to be pursued with any degree of alacrity.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is incredibly alarming. At present, this is just constrained to trade, but it's hard not to see this not spilling over into other areas, including security, for example. So I think the consequences of this are extremely severe. We don't want to live in a world that is transactional, because that will always favor the bigger economies. So we want to live in a rules-based world where even small economies like our own have an opportunity to defend their interests. But the way this is escalating, that is looking increasingly unlikely.
So, Donald, given that the rules in many respects are being torn up as we speak, how should South Africa and maybe Southern Africa more broadly be interpreting this warning, and what should we be doing to mitigate?
Yeah, also I think we want to very deliberately avoid picking sides in this fight. There would appear to be no upside to favoring either side in this. I think we need to look at them and let them settle their differences and try as best as possible to not be caught in the crossfire. And that would really apply to the whole of Africa, because the whole of the continent is being fought over, which, you know, feels very kind of reminiscent of 100 years ago. So we've got something very similar that is occurring at the moment. Africa finds itself in the middle. You know, I think we need to steadfastly focus on our own interests, try to avoid being an active participant, and see what happens when the dust settles, which hopefully is fairly soon, but could drag on for a long time if the two belligerent parties don't find a way to settle their differences.
But increasingly, it will become more difficult to pursue a non-aligned trade strategy in this very vociferous climate.
Yes, it absolutely would. And the US in particular is making this very difficult. If this was just between the US and China, it would be a little bit easier. We could just continue trading as we have before. But the US has now placed at minimum a 10% tariff on all of our exports, except those that they've excluded. And then, of course, the potential of that rising to 30% in 3 months' time. And so that makes this even more difficult. It is, if you like, pushing us towards the Chinese side, but at the same time wanting to penalize us if we move in that direction. So absolutely, this is going to be an incredibly difficult tightrope for us to walk.
And Donald, part of the problem is inertia as far as South Africa is concerned, because we've had a very wishy-washy promise from the presidency saying, well, we are going to engage with representatives in the United States of America. To the best of my knowledge, none of that has happened.
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, that's true. I mean, I hope we're both wrong on that, Jeremy, but that is as I understand it too. I think a substantial part of the problem is we don't know what the Trump presidency wants from South Africa. So we know what they are threatening to do, but they're not telling us what they would expect to not do it, if you like. So making it very difficult. You know, how do you negotiate if the other person is just threatening to hit you after 3 months, but is not giving you an out, which is the position we seem to find ourselves in? Now, the US has said, you need to come with proposals. What are you offering? But that's difficult to know. So, for example, Europe said, we will agree to no tariffs on anything out of the US. And Trump said he's not interested in that. But he started saying that they want to have, you know, they want to have access into other markets to the same degree they give into theirs. But when that offer has been made, Europe and Israel have both offered it, Trump has simply said no. So we don't really know what they want, making this very, very difficult to negotiate.
And Donald, just finally, I don't want to be accused of hunting for a good headline here, but maybe I am. It's patently obvious the era of global trade cooperation is either over or has changed significantly, as you've outlined. There's no doubt that we're entering a cold economic war, or is that too much too soon?
No, we're already in, and from an economic perspective, the war is not really cold at all. Shots have been fired from all sides. I think what is more concerning is that by the US particularly completely isolating China from its market, the incentive that China had, for example, beforehand to not do something like invade Taiwan was this concern that if we did invade, we'd be cut off from the global trading system, as they saw happened to Russia. But when you've preemptively cut them off to a substantial degree and are attempting to isolate them completely, then certainly those incentives start to reduce. And then you're really only looking at whatever military risk assessment they do. But the economic leverage that the US had, I think they've dramatically diminished. So we could find ourselves in a kind of a true Cold War situation as we had beforehand between the US and the Soviet Union, which would, of course, be a truly terrible, terrible outcome. But from an economic perspective, you know, shots have been fired. It's a hot war.
Donald McKay, your insight and analysis is always appreciated. From XA Global Trade Advisors, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, if you've watched the television series Adolescence, you'll know that it's not just another moody teen drama. A 13-year-old kills a classmate. It is horrific and compelling. But beneath the horror lies a real-world issue that many parents are missing. What am I talking about? The brutality of growing up online. From group chats that never sleep to digital exclusion and also cyberbullying, the new schoolyard is virtual and it is ruthless. Joining us now, who is someone who has a perspective on this, it's Arno Jansen van Vuren, Managing Director at the education finance company FutureWise. And I want to examine what digital drama is doing to our children, emotionally, academically, and psychologically. And Arno, a very warm welcome to you. And I wonder sometimes whether parents underestimate just how horrific and brutal this online world is for teenagers.
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy. Listen, I think you summed it up perfectly. It's a massive problem. And I think parents might be forgiven to think that the teenage drama and adolescent drama has always been there. Bullying has always existed. People have been excluded and not invited to things or even ridiculed. But in this digital first world, I think the digital part in digital drama absolutely just amplifies what's been happening, and that plays out in a non-stop environment, fast-paced, and a lot of the times under the cover of your phone and darkness and in your own room and in a very isolated way, whereas normally these things would play out in the schoolyard and the halls and even in the family room at home. So it's a massive challenge, and I think parents absolutely have their hands full to manage this and to support their kids.
We can talk about support in just a moment, but the reality is so many parents, I would imagine, are completely ignorant as to what is happening behind the closed door at night.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, it's a scary thought. I've got a 2.5-year-old girl. She's not exposed to phones and to screens yet, and it's not a world that we can keep her in. She's going to get involved in all the digital technologies. And I think as a parent, trying to navigate how do you get your kids exposure to all the things that take their thinking forward, that do brain development, that help them to be an active participant and citizen in society, but then to know that you have to learn new skills to be involved, to be supportive, to be there, and even to have the kind of relationship where you let in to understand what happens on their phone and behind a closed door, in a way that parents never had to do and to understand in previous sort of decades or generations. Because I think the challenge here is when the door of the room closed in 30 years ago, your child was contained to that room, to their thoughts, maybe to a phone line. But now the whole world is at their fingertips, and it's a massive challenge for parents.
And I think what many parents often underestimate is how quickly that peer pressure experienced online can not only turn toxic, but as we saw in this television series, Adolescence, dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that we need to be on the lookout for constantly as parents and people with children in our lives, because as you rightly mentioned, it's such a stark reminder. And I think that's why a show like Adolescence has been so incredibly talked about. Every friend and colleague that I've spoken to in the last couple of weeks starts with, have you seen Adolescence? What do you think? Have you? Because I think people realize just how misinformed we sometimes are and how big that problem is and how the things that we've always maybe thought, like social media, might become a problem at some point. We actually let this genie out the box. Are we going to close the Pandora's box? Now you start realizing the next generation's already dealing with us, and they didn't have a time to grow up and figure themselves out before they got the internet in their pocket and the whole world at their fingertips. They've got to do that in real time with access to this worldwide sort of pressures and things going on.
Have you learned or have you applied your mind to how you can support a child without invading their digital privacy? Or is there a certain age where digital privacy doesn't count, that a parent should be involved in everything?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very cool thing to think about. And I'll definitely spend the next couple of years and trying to figure out what is the right age. But I think there's the time where digital privacy isn't something that actually exists. But the moment you get to a point where you say, listen, we have got to now trust this child that we have brought up and that we are helping and that we are teaching. I think there's, for me, three guiding principles, and that's just me, but I think you got to build a relationship, and that starts day one. And we know that as kids get older, that relationship gets tested and it gets pulled. But I feel like if you build a relationship that rests on trust without judgment, I think whenever something goes wrong or when there's trauma or there's any difficult situation, you know that your child can trust you to not judge them and to be there for them. I think that relationship is extremely important. But I think we've got to also look at ourselves. We've got to set an example. So how do we behave with screen time, with our phones? How do we set boundaries and keep to them? How do we then also mirror that to our kids, not do what we say, but knowing that they'll do what we do? I think setting an example is really important. And then to be attentive. I mean, listen, there's a lot going on and the world moves fast, but any changes in your child's behavior, when the emojis change, we saw a lot of emojis playing a big part in the show. If they engage a lot more, a lot less than they usually did, like stuff like they're not sleeping or their engagement at school's changing. Like there's a lot of signs that normally we can see afterwards. And obviously that normally comes when it's too late, when we have already seen something go wrong. So I really believe if you stick with those three, and as a parent, I think you spend your time with your children and you figure out what works for you and what works for them. It's important to be there.
So just a final question then. Organizations such as yours that play in the education space, what should you be doing?
Yeah, we just believe that whole child education is the answer. We normally think about our kids' education, what are their maths, literacy, what does their science look like? How are they engaging with tech? And we do a lot as FutureWise to ensure those things are in place. But we really believe that a part of the whole child education is also to look after their emotional well-being and their digital well-being and how they engage in this new digital world. So we've launched a partnership with Social Kids to make sure that kids get access to resources of learning how to protect yourself online and to also pull parents in to say, can we talk about these things? Can we talk about this digital world and what goes on our kids' phones and how can we support them better? And then as FutureWise, we try and step in and say, we'll give you education insurance, we'll give you savings, but we'll also give you tools to help your kids and to sort out their whole child education journey. And I think that's the first step.
And if you are a parent, particularly of a teenager, and you haven't seen this series, Adolescence, it is harrowing. It's well worth the watch, though. My thanks to Arno Janssen van Vuren, Managing Director at the education finance company FutureWise. Arno, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, is recycled toilet water already in your tap? And the answer to this question may shock you. As water infrastructure crumbles, reuse is really becoming a necessity, but without the public possibly even knowing about it. So how is this new paradigm playing out? My guest is Herman Stoop, who is Governance, Risk and Compliance Officer at Worldwide Industrial and Systems Engineers. Herman, a very warm welcome to you. Are South Africans already drinking recycled wastewater?
Thank you, Jeremy. I think a high number of South African consumers are already drinking the water without necessarily knowing that it is recycled wastewater. But it does happen.
Is it important that this is something that we know about?
It is very important because there is a huge problem with water treatment in South Africa per se. Most of the municipalities have difficulty in providing clean drinking water to their consumers. So what happens is that about 90% of used water is discharged untreated into our rivers and dams and streams, but some of that water is now diverted back to the consumer. And if it's not treated properly, then obviously it leads to things like cholera and other illnesses.
So, Herman, let's talk about the importance then of that treatment. What infrastructure failures in that respect then are making the current system risky and what needs to change?
I think it's the maintenance of water treatment facilities at municipalities that is the main problem, because the Auditor General report mentioned that about 39% of wastewater treatment works in South Africa is in a poor or critically state. So the problem is with that, that the people do not receive, the consumers do not receive clean drinking water currently. So what often happens is that even wastewater is not treated properly and then it gets fed back into the system and you receive it via the taps in your house and it's not treated properly. So it is a health danger. The way forward is for the municipalities and the wastewater treatment facilities to implement measures to make sure that the water is treated properly, because properly treated water can be safe. So even if it is recycled wastewater, it can be safe to drink, provided that the measures are put in place in order to treat it properly based on international best practice and then monitored regularly. Unfortunately, none of those things currently happen.
Well, let's talk about that then. Critical to the point that you've just made is that municipalities need to follow ISO or global safety standards, I imagine. The problem, of course, is these international standards can't really work in these under-resourced towns. So it would seem to me that unless there is a paradigm shift as far as that particular issue is concerned, the situation is going to remain pretty much the same.
And that is currently the problem. We have worked with some municipalities in South Africa as consultants, and we've implemented international standards such as ISO 9001, which is the quality standard, or 24510, which is the drinking water and wastewater standard, as well as ISO 14046, which is a water footprint standard. Where we've been able to implement that together with the water service provider and the municipality, the quality and the regular testing and the way that the water is treated has improved considerably. And in those regards, safe drinking water can be recovered from wastewater. And that's happened in places like Durban and Beaufort West and George and Mossel Bay and obviously Cape Town, which most people know about. But the problem is the municipalities do not spend money on maintenance as it is. And now for them to spend additional money on implementing a standard when they don't even do the basics right, that is where the problem comes in. There has to be a paradigm shift from these municipalities to realize that in order to keep the consumer safe, they need to implement these standards and follow best practice. Otherwise, the wastewater quality will just keep reducing over time.
And Herman, to what extent then is the Department of Water and Sanitation a critical part of this equation?
Obviously, the municipalities look towards the department for leadership and guidance. And I think the department issues regularly instructions to municipalities to consider implementing best practice, to consider implementing regular monitoring. But most of these municipalities either disregard the advice from the department. They even disregard the laws that were created by the department. So that in itself creates a difficult situation. And where we found that we have approached the municipalities or they have approached us for assistance, that's where there was a paradigm shift in terms of management at the municipality, would they decided that they need to do something because there is a critical shortage of drinking water for the consumer. And we need that on a global scale throughout the country, not just individual municipalities here and there. We need it throughout the country in order to save South Africa from a real crisis in terms of drinking water quality.
Herman Stoop, thank you for throwing some light on a very important issue here. He's a governance, risk and compliance officer at Worldwide Industrial and Systems Engineers. I do appreciate your time and your insight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in a world where business leaders are expected to be everything these days, I guess an innovator, a mentor, a strategist, even an operator, it's easy to get lost in all of this noise and in the weeds. But I'm wondering if there's a clearer way to focus your energy. Well, perhaps there is. Independent business advisor Juanita Forster offers just that with her new Next and Never Money model. What is it? Well, it's a framework for understanding where your income is coming from. Most importantly, what future growth looks like and why not everything worth doing actually needs to make money. Got a bit of a question mark next to that one. Well, Juanita joins us now to discuss how this model works and where most people are getting it wrong. Juanita, welcome to you. So are most leaders too obsessed with money, making it in the immediate frame, and maybe missing a bigger picture? Is that the thrust of your argument?
The thrust of my argument is that the world has changed and will keep on changing, and we've got to figure out a new way to think about money and leadership. So in the generation I grew up, leadership and money had a certain connection to it. You know, it was success, and success was based on the financial measurements, and everything you do in leadership is towards increasing performance, increased results, all of these things. But what we're seeing, if we're looking at the future of work, if we're looking at the future of the world, and now we're forecasting a little bit further than 2030, more towards 2050, it will require a different set of skills. It will require a different focus. And I love that you said it's a simpler way to think of things, to move away from the things that we were taught and that we are used to, and to start saying, is everything really just about money and just about now money? What about the future?
So how do you start recalibrating your thinking to fit in with the model that you're proposing? And wherein is the benefit?
Simply by thinking now money, next money, and never money, and putting question marks to all of it and translating for yourself, figure out for yourself what it means for you. Because this now money, next money, never money framework is just a way of thinking for yourself to see you as a business leader. And here I must be very clear, it's not for the regular 8-to-5 worker necessarily, not for someone starting their career, and definitely not talking about side hustles. Here I'm talking about business leaders who have a little bit more room to play in terms of decisions, in terms of where time and effort of themselves or their businesses are focused, and thinking about the things that are keeping me up at night. Are they for now? Are they only focused on how the business makes money right now, how the business is staying alive right now, how it's performing right now? Or am I taking into account that while I am managing a high performance business, I also have to allocate some of its energy towards making itself ready for the future? I personally don't like this term future proofing, because if you waterproof something, water doesn't come in. We need to be future ready, not future proofed. What am I doing now to ready the business and my people for the future? And then obviously the never aspect of it, where it's not just about money, but where in whatever the world is going about, businesses, business leaders also selflessly takes care of the planet, its people, communities, and so on, not for tax benefits, not for CSI initiatives, but just because it's the right thing to do. And there's the argument.
All right. So, Juanita, let me push back on your argument a little bit, if I can.
Please.
You talk about leaders, again, of established organizations, and you suggest that they have a little bit of room to play. In other words, a bit of maneuverability. But surely in tough economic times, that has telescoped a lot, that we are really in a short-term economy and that we don't really have time to lift our head above the parapet and scan the broader horizon, as you're suggesting.
And that is unfortunately one of the mistakes I see business leaders make. I'm not suggesting that this framework is good to implement right now, because if you look at the mix between now money, next money, and never money, it's all about the mix. And that mix changes according to market conditions, according to team conditions, according to culture, according to industry, all of those types of things. So if you had this framework in mind and have been working to it, you would have shifted that mix more focused on the now money, but the next money and the never money would still tick along, would still be in the back of your mind, so that when times turns, when there's less pressured on you, there is a little bit more space to turn the mix back to not a balance, but to a mix that works well in different times. So it's not starting now, but also not forgetting that times might be tough and they might never become untough again. And still, the future is ours to create. The future is our responsibility. So we've got to adapt a different way of thinking, even if we can't do anything practically about it right now.
All right. So where's the starting point for any business that might be attracted to this way of thinking, this philosophy?
The now money, I'm hoping, is very clearly defined. If it's not, please start there. That is what funds this entire thing. Without the now money, the next money and the never money becomes a whole different conversation. So make sure you've got the now money sorted in terms of your team composition, in terms of leadership, in terms of product, customer service, all the financial and non-financial results you need to deliver. And then start thinking, well, what could my or my business's next money potentially be? And that next money isn't just next iteration of your current products and services. It isn't the next iteration or the same market or the next generation of the same market that you're operating in. It's completely different. So it doesn't make as much money, and it definitely doesn't move as quickly. And you can't expect the same level of maturity in the next money, but you've got to start thinking about what that could possibly be. And this exact same for never, saying, what capacity do I have? So that you don't make the mistake of overcommitting, whether it's sitting on a not-for-profit board, executive director, being a volunteer at your local charity, wherever it is. So you don't overcommit because the now money is so tough at the moment, but that you start thinking about, where can I really make a difference? Not expecting anything back in terms of visibility. It's not a strategic decision. It's an impact decision.
Just very quickly in conclusion, how do you find the healthy balance between now, next, and never?
Healthy balance does not exist. It's a mix. And you choose your mix based on what works for you and what works for your business. And you've got to keep on changing it because nothing in life is stationary anymore.
Juanita Forster, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time and the thinking. And that is our program for today. We are back tomorrow live at noon, then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.